ten after, and just about ten after. Do you have ten after?
This is a big deal for you.
Yeah, I've never missed mass before.
So, that's good. This is that, and you need a, you need, how many people need the class notes from chapter 18?
I mean, I do have a copy, but it would be easier for me to.
I think one more, Cora doesn't have this.
Thank you.
Cora?
Cora, is this?
This is the.
No, Courtney's today's.
No, today's one.
Today's handout that you gave.
Today's handout, yes, I gave a handout for today, Cora needs that, all right.
Are you gonna use the old ones too?
If you have the old ones, or if you don't, I have extras for chapter 18. They're here, I'll leave them on the table. If you need them, there's two more. Okay, we going? So I wanna thank you for being here, this is really above and beyond the call of duty, and for the sake of those who will be listening to this on recording, I have to indicate that this is a re-recording of the lecture that originally was delivered on March the 11th, and we're re-recording it on March 24th because of some technical difficulties with the earlier recording. The lecture that was given on March 11th, and which I'm going to repeat as well as I can today, was primarily on Chapter 18 of Insight. But we began, and we will begin today, with a few items that were left over from the class on March the 4th that dealt with the second half of Chapter 17, basically Section 3 of Chapter 17. And if you're listening to the recording, you should be aware that not all of the class is present for this lecture, but that some people very generously agreed to come back and to discuss these materials once again. So I'm very, very happy that
for
you are here.
Consideration for pay.
Yeah, right. And you should also be aware that we've already had an intervening class in which Chapter 19 was discussed. And when you hear listen to the recording of Chapter 19, you'll see that it circled back on some of the items in Chapter 18, and especially on freedom with respect to decision, the relationship between decision and knowledge. Okay, so what I want to do then is to begin with some items that were left over from the discussion of Chapter 17, from the discussion especially of the second half of Chapter 17. In the class on March the 4th, there was a great deal of discussion of the universal viewpoint and potential totality of genetically and dialectically related viewpoints. And a number of questions were raised about the possibility of distinguishing different kinds of literature, and especially distinguishing philosophical texts and literary texts. I commented in the class that Lonergan is presenting in the chapter primarily a hermeneutic theory for philosophic texts. And the question was raised, especially from the standpoint of postmodern literature, deconstructionism, and so on, well, is there really any distinction between philosophical texts and literary texts? Is that really just an artificial distinction? So the point was made, for instance, that the dialogues of Plato are both philosophical and literary, and that many of the writings of Kierkegaard can be considered at once religious, literary, and philosophical. And so is it legitimate to make a distinction of different kinds of texts? It didn't occur to me in the course of that discussion on March the 4th that there is another feature of the upper blade of a scientific hermeneutics besides the universal viewpoint that addresses, and this other feature addresses these concerns. Namely, the suggestion that a theory of interpretation needs also some account of levels and sequences of expression, not so much in terms of language or style, but in terms of meaning. Lonergan actually says that the upper blade of a scientific hermeneutics is constituted by two things, the universal viewpoint, which is based in cognitional theory, and an account of the levels and sequences of expression. And that is the part that addresses this concern of the different types of texts, or the question whether there are different types of texts. And basically what he's saying is this, that just as every hermeneutic theory, and in fact every attempt at interpretation, will be working from some implicit or explicit cognitional theory, and so then he presents his own, which will form part of the relative a priori from which an interpreter understands the viewpoint or viewpoints in the literature that he or she is studying, so too every hermeneutic theory and every attempt at interpretation will have some implicit or explicit view of the levels and sequences of expression, or whether there are such things. So if Derrida, for instance, is saying that there is no distinction between philosophic and literary texts, well, that's his view, and he's making it very explicit. And what Lonergan is doing is making his own view explicit here. So when one says there really is no difference, one is working from such a view, just as one is working from a contrary view if one distinguishes literary and philosophic texts. So what Lonergan's proposing on this issue in chapter 17 is the account of the levels and sequences of expression that would follow from his own cognitional theory. And he's leaving it up to us to accept it or to reject it. Perhaps we want to go with some other theory, but this is what he's giving us, that from his own cognitional theory there will follow a certain account of levels and sequences of expression, so that you can talk about different types of texts and different types of writing and different types even of vocal expression. Chris?
Can you just refresh my memory on what the levels and sequences of expression are, just like i.e. ding, ding, ding?
That's what we're going to do right now.
Oh, okay.
It's right here. So thus,
okay.
It's the next thing. In number 10 on the notes that I distributed for that class, and I'm just repeating here, for the rest of these notes, I'm repeating what I had in numbers 10, 11, and 12. So you don't really need to go back to your old notes unless you want to, but in number 10 on the notes that I distributed for the original class in this part of chapter 17, it is stated that different levels of expression are rooted in different sources of meaning in the speaker or writer and in the hearer or reader. So the key to the different levels of expression will be the different sources of meaning. And recall that for Lonergan, any cognitional activity is a source of meaning. Seeing is a source of meaning. Questioning is a source of meaning. Understanding, conceiving, reflecting, judging, those are all sources of meaning. So, and here's the answer to your question, Chris, it's on the next page, a quote from page 592 in the book. An expression may have its source, one, simply in the experience of the speaker, as in an exclamation. You trip and you scream. That's an expression that is simply an expression that is rooted in your experience. You trip and you fall and you hurt yourself and you call out and cry or you say ouch or whatever. Secondly, it may have its source in artistically ordered experiential elements, as in a song or in some kind of expression of intimate dialogue between people or whatever, but a song is the example that he gives. That's the source of that is artistically ordering experiential elements. There certainly would be an element of insight and judgment and so on, but it's basically a matter of artistically ordering different things. Or thirdly, it may have its source in a reflectively tested, intelligent ordering of experiential elements, that should be of, as in a statement of fact. Or finally, it may have its source in the addition of acts of will, such as wishes and commands. I ask you to do this, I beg you to do this, I desire that you do this, I order you to do this. So adding those to intellectual and rational knowledge. In turn, when I say something to you, I might intend you to respond, one, simply on the experiential level, in an intersubjective reproduction of my feelings, moods, sentiments, images, associations. If I'm in pain and I'm just crying, well, that's, I just want you to share that, you know? So I want you to respond on that level, intersubjectively, to my feelings, to my pain or whatever. Or secondly, I may want you to respond both on the level of experience and on the level of insight and consideration. Or thirdly, I may want you to respond on the three levels of experience, insight, and judgment. If I'm trying to persuade you, and I'm trying to make a point that I want you to agree with, well, then I want you to judge with me as well. And finally, I may want you to respond not only on those three cognitional levels, but also in the practical manner that includes an act of will, such as last week when I asked if anyone would like to come to another class. You know, that it was not just, I didn't want you simply to say, Yes, I'd like to, you know, to respond simply on the level of understanding and judgment, but to do it, and here you are. You see, you're responding on another level besides just the cognitional level. You've chosen to be here in the practical manner that included an act of will or a decision on your part to be here. So, as expression becomes specialized, the intended response can become more manifest. And he gives examples of that. Advertisers and propaganda ministries aim at psychological conditioning. They don't want you to raise the questions that would lead to insight and judgment and decision. They want you to respond on the level of impulse. They desire neither adequate insight, nor detached reflection, nor rational choices, but simply the establishment of types of habituation, familiarity, association, automatism that will dispense with further questions. I mentioned the movie The Corporation, and particularly the part in that movie where they show how the advertisers, the corporations, are going after children, and simply to habituate their impulsive responses to things, and then to pester their parents until the parents get this thing for them. But it's not trying to raise any questions or move them to judgment or anything. It's simply to habituate them to making associations. That you've got to have this or you're just not going to be cool or whatever it is. In contrast, literary writing, it's different from the writing of advertisers. Literary writing does convey insights and stimulate reflection, but for the most part its mode of operation is indirect. If there's no frontal attack on the reader's intelligence, there is the insinuation of insights through the images from which they subtly emerge. If there's no methodical summing up of the pros and cons of a judgment, as it would be in a book like Insight, for instance, there is an unhurried and almost incidental display of the evidence without perhaps even a suggested question. So when you're reading a novel or whatever, well, there is the insinuation of insight, but it's literary, it's indirect, and it's insight into human living and so on.
That includes cultural myth.
Cultural myths?
Myth, yeah.
Such as?
Native myths, for instance.
Oh, probably, yes, I would think so. Yeah.
Creation stories, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and there may be more. There's probably more that's intended in that than simply it would be. Because I'm going to go on for, can we leave that for just a minute?
Okay.
Because a couple of paragraphs later I've got another suggestion here. Just quoting Lonergan to conclude with what he says there. So we've had experience, like advertising, for instance, experience and insight, literary writing. Direct concern with the reader's understanding appears in scientific writing, and especially explanatory understanding. And direct concern with the reader's judgments emerges in philosophic writing, where there is the concern for truth. Now, that's as far as he goes here in this chapter in speaking of the levels of expression, but I was typing this morning, and this is something that I've added to what I said a couple of weeks ago. We could go on to understand Kierkegaard's expression, for example. If Fred Crow, for instance, is right that with Kierkegaard you've got the differentiation of a fourth level of consciousness, perhaps more sharply than in previous thinkers. Well, Kierkegaard's writing is connected with the fourth and fifth levels of moral and religious living. And he's conveying, but sometimes technically, but most often, as he himself said, through indirect communication, so through the same kind of communication as you have in literary writing, he's communicating what he called the midnight cry to authenticity that he tried to utter in the circumstances of the church and the philosophy of his time. So you could think of his writing as proceeding primarily from fourth and fifth levels and addressed to the existential subject, not to you as experiencing, understanding, and judging, but to you as forced to make decisions and to you as called to respond to God in faith. Now, I would see religious expression, including like the sorts of things that you're talking about, as related to coming from the religious dimensions of our consciousness and intending a response on the religious level of consciousness. So in other words, what Lonergan is saying is simply that his own cognitional theory does provide some basis for talking about levels of expression. that some expression proceeds primarily from the experience, from the level of experience, some from experience and understanding together. Some is interested in technical understanding, for instance, scientific writing. Some is interested in the question of truth. Some is interested in the question of authenticity, personal value, and so on. And so you could talk about different levels of expression from the standpoint of incarnation theory. That would be some kind of alternative, I would think, to the position that would say that there really is no difference between literary and philosophic writing. If you root your position on textual expression, for instance, if you root that in an interiority analysis that distinguishes levels of conscious awareness, then perhaps you have a basis for talking about levels of expression. Levels here, I don't think, should be taken hierarchically. There's nothing more valuable about a philosophical piece of work than there is about a great piece of literature. It's just that the levels are one metaphor that we use for the sources of meaning in cognitive acts. Do we have any questions on this first? Then there will be the issue of sequences of expression, which is related. Chris?
So would you say then that Kierkegaard kind of operates in literary and philosophical genres then?
And I would say that in his work, there's a new dimension added to the philosophical because he's appealing beyond the cognitive to the existential in a way that is sharply, in his time, in the middle of the 19th century, this was new in philosophical literature. It was a new appeal that there's more to life than is, well, his basic reaction, if you want, is that it's twofold. It's against Hegel in philosophy, and it's against religious inauthenticity in the Lutheran Church of Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really writing against both of those, and they're two different fronts that he's writing on. But in the philosophical, he's simply saying, that the German idealism, as he became aware of it in Hegel, really helped him make no decisions with regard to his own life, and there were concrete decisions that he had to make, and the individual and his or her decisions are simply left out of this philosophy. And he wants to bring that back into philosophy, and so he's appealing now to a whole other level of operation that is not simply cognitive.
Yes. So then could you say that, like with Lonergan's theory, you have different levels of expression that correspond to intentional operations as their sources of meaning, so that within any given text, you could see a dynamic moving in and out of levels of expression that Lonergan's theory allows us to be able to chart this movement in a way that brings it back to our own understanding so that we can properly understand what any author is doing in a given time. So it's not so much a segmented, this is literature, this is philosophy, this is science and history, but that these, in a given text, that we can see how these things move in and out of these different genres.
I think that's very good. I think it's a very good point. Thank you for that.
Well, I think that that's kind of what Derrida's saying, is that these, well, I mean, I don't want to get into, but I'm just saying that it's the notion that you're going to break down these borders. And yeah, but that's good.
Yeah.
In a way, I think it also parallels, because as we are doing this, I was thinking of the different notions of intelligence that psychologists are talking about today.
Mm.
And it does seem to me that something like experience, understanding, and judgment is more basic than everything else. That in a way it has to be the basis, let's say, of an intelligence, of, I don't know, even of each, a genius of artistic expression.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm just wondering at the connection, but I still have to think about it.
Well, let me come back to that, because I think in the light of what Chris was saying, I'm going to come back in a moment, but I want to get Sean's point first.
I agree with Chris, and I do think this is very helpful in terms of breaking down some of looking at genre or looking at types of discourse in a rigid way, that a certain work can exist, can be both philosophical and literary, or philosophical, literary, and theological.
Mm-hmm.
The question I had is, this question came up for us in the discussion of authorial intent in some way, that we can understand what an author was trying to say. The question that I have is that for any author, and even a philosophical author, and this was my question of, can we really distinguish philosophy, theology, literature, history? The philosopher many times is going to have to rely on the same literary devices or same linguistic devices that the poet, the novelist, the historian, metaphor being the principal one. You know, literature is metaphorical. All theology is metaphorical, I've heard that said, or analogical, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
History, same thing. We use metaphor to explain or describe or whatever. And with metaphor, you may have an intended meaning, but other meanings come along for the ride.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it very difficult in the absence of the speaker, and that's really the hermeneutical question I'm after, is in the absence of the speaker, when you just have a text, trying to weave your way back through the various meanings that can come along in a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
What did the author intend? I mean, there are lots of... the Plato one came up... You know, Plato has lots of different ones. The metaphor of the sun in the cave allegory. The sun is truth. All right, well, truth, using that metaphor, it illumines, it exposes, it reveals, it clarifies. It blinds, if you look at it another way. It burns, if you're out in it too long. We know now it causes cancer. So there are other meanings that go along in using a metaphor. So if a philosopher is having to use metaphorical language to explain something, the idea that we can understand the intent of that philosopher is at least problematic. I'm not saying it's impossible. Others would say it's impossible. I would say at least it's problematic. And it's on that level that I'm wondering how Lonergan responds. And some of the postmoderns go so far as to say, like, scientific language is itself problematic on that level, that scientists have to use imprecise language, or they have to use language which necessarily is imprecise.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't say exactly how I would respond to it, but when you think of this book, and let me come back in the same context to Chris's statement, but when you think of this book itself, there's a series of metaphors that are really required, I think, if you're going to understand what he's talking about. You're going to have some metaphor to talk about the different levels of consciousness. Levels itself is a metaphorical expression, so that's a hierarchical. It's a spatial metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
I've suggested, other people have suggested, that really we should try to get away from the level and we should try to find some other, like interlocking circles or whatever. But whatever you do, and I think interlocking circles has some real value to it that gets beyond some of the obstacles in the level metaphor and gets closer to what I think the meaning of the text is. But nobody's really done it yet. Because they do interact. The thing is that the levels of consciousness, the levels or the dimensions of consciousness interact with one another in a way that levels doesn't convey unless you've got arrows shooting up and down and that sort of thing. Okay, so you're going to have a metaphors, but in this book, I think it is fairly clear in most parts of the book what he's intending to communicate. Now, with respect to Plato, my guess is that the myth of the cave that you're talking about, he's really talking about a conversion, an intellectual conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Periagoge is the word that he uses, which is a turning around from the illusions to the truth, and from seeming to truth, from basically from experience to understanding is what he's got. At least that's what I would want to say he's after there. You know. Is it true that the sun also burns and scalds and causes cancer? Yes, but is that central to his meaning at this point? I doubt it.
Right. No, I agree. It's just it's that on some level, all of these discourses have the same problem.
That's
because
true.
They're bound by language.
Yeah, they are bound by language, and they're bound by metaphor.
Right.
They are. Yeah.
And so it was just this question of authorial intent.
Yeah.
To me, it remains always, that remains always problematic. That you can, and I think Lonergan does this, and the people who've picked up on Lonergan's hermeneutics seem to be doing this, is that you can get to a best sense.
Yeah.
But other senses come along for the ride, whether you like it or not.
I think that's as far as he would want to go. Okay. The best sense is as far as he would want to go. I mean, the way he said it, and he said it from very early on, is hypothetical is as close as you're going to get in terms of the positive grasp of what another author intended. Negatively, you can be certain that a person did not mean some things. You can be certain of that. But positively, what an author meant, well, the best available opinion or the best sense is probably the best you're going to do. He said that in writing his dissertation, and he never changed his mind on that. Now, I think, however, that you know, what he intended with this book, there's an awful lot of things that can be said with a certain amount of definiteness, I think, you know,
right.
What he intends. And let me take a stab at this in terms of what you were saying before, because I was thinking as you were commenting about the different levels of expression, they're all in here. There's the pre-linguistic kind of way of, I mean, he said right from the very beginning that he's trying to convey a pre-conceptual experience. And so he's got to use some things that just hint to get you at that. To get you at the movement from the flow of sensations to the grasp of some kind of order in those before there's any conceptualization of that grasp. The first 10 chapters are not concerned with judgment. They're concerned with understanding. And he makes it very clear, I don't intend you to make a judgment in this book until chapter 11. I want you to assemble the elements and see whether it makes sense. But that's still understanding. It's not whether you affirm it yet or not until chapter 11. Mm-hmm. Chapter 11, he calls for a judgment. And from that point on, he's calling for judgments. Thoroughly understand what it is to understand, and you will understand the broad lines of all there is to be understood, and so on. And he says, ultimately, this self-appropriation of one's rational self-consciousness is a personal decisive act. And so he's calling you to a decision in the course of the whole book. There's a change that he wants to take place. But the all of the levels are operative at different parts of the book, I think, you know. So,
yes.
So I think your comment about in any one text that the different levels of expression are pertinent at different points is absolutely right.
Yeah, I was thinking about this conversation too. When you're with your comments, like, you know, David Tracy's work on the analogical imagination.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly I think the kinds of things that he's getting at. You know, noting the profound similarities and difference, but it's always that similarities and difference,
right.
And that.
Well, it exposes too the artifice of genre. That these are constructions. What is philosophy? What is literature? What is theology? What is history? Where a certain book falls under, that's all artifice. And we need to come to higher viewpoints to expose the genetic and complementary and dialectical differences to see where those actually are. And I think the postmodernist, and I think this book points us in that direction.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's helpful. Dorothy, anything else?
I just had a small point, Bob. It's related to the problem of levels of consciousness. And sometimes, for me, the term moments, moving into the whole understanding of time, which resists, I think, the flatness, possibly, of a notion of level, and the interrelatedness of all of those.
Yeah. I think we do. I think it's worth thinking of whether there aren't other better metaphors than levels.
But there are times when levels, I think, promotes a kind of clarity.
It does. It does.
And so I wouldn't want to dismiss.
As long as that clarity doesn't become a conceptualist grid, you know, which would be the farthest thing from his intentions, if I may speak of his intentions. But I think you know, that's the last thing in the world that he wants. Okay, number 11 in the notes from that class went on to talk about. It just indicated that the distinction of levels of expression grounds not an actual but a potential classification of expressions. Further differentiations and nuances are possible, so it's not a lockstep kind of grid that he's presenting here. The interpreter remains free to exercise subtlety in determining a writer's sources of meaning and intention. Yet it does prevent one from assuming that all expression originates from and is directed to a single level, Or we may add, and this is my addition, that the distinctions of different kinds of expression are really illusory, as perhaps, now maybe I'm wrong here, as perhaps might be maintained by some deconstructionist readings. I don't know whether I'm right in that or not. At least this proposal of levels of expression will provide a different reading from one that would assert that there really is no distinction between philosophical and writing. Finally, number 12 on the notes, expressions also exhibit sequences. Expression develops, it moves from the undifferentiated to the differentiated, from the generic to the specific. I really should have done a spell check on this before I put this out, but I wrote it quite quickly this morning. From the global and awkward to the expert and precise. Specialized modes of expression have evolved. Working out, and I think one of the questions that this gives rise to, and that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago as well, is what does this mean in terms of where expression is heading, expression that comes out of this kind of vision, or for that matter, out of Heidegger and postmodern writers. Where are we heading in terms of even our philosophic modes of expression? Specialized modes of expression have evolved. Working out types of expression is a matter not of assigning static classifications, but of determining the operators that related the classifications relevant to one level of development to the classifications relevant to the next. That's an interesting point that he leaves open here. He never tells us just what these operators are. What are the operators that bring about new modes of expression? I speculated in Theology and the Dialectics of History that the most pertinent operators for new modes of expression are the exigences that establish distinct realms of meaning. These exigences, some of them at least, are treated in Method and Theology, pages 81 to 85. With the emergence of the Socratic, the Platonic, the Aristotelian, for instance, in Western history, there is a systematic exigence that separates the world of common sense from the world of theory. Now, that systematic exigence has developed. Modern science, Aristotle wouldn't recognize what modern science is doing. And modern science is a development upon that systematic exigence. There's a critical exigence that moves to the world of interiority. How do you distinguish between the realms of reality that are intended by common sense and theory? Is one real and the other illusory? Or are they both real? And if so, how? And how do they relate to one another? And so on. There's a methodical exigence that returns from interiority to differentiate the various sciences and relate their methods to one another. And there's a transcendent exigence that relates us to the transcendental objectives and ultimately to God. Those are the four that he speaks of in those four or five pages in Method and Theology. I think there's no reason why we cannot also speak of exigences for artistic expression and probably a number of more exigences. And those exigences would be possibly the operators or the principal operators for different modes of expression. At any rate, a very salutary emphasis that does find its way, in my view, into the discussion in chapter 17 is the mention of the difficulty that is experienced by an artistic, a scientific, or a philosophical innovator. Because for the innovator, the established modes of expression are insufficient, and yet the new mode has not yet evolved. So the people in other forms of expression as well have this difficulty. Music, you've got a whole new thing, and what's your medium for expressing it? And it has to, you got to give it time for that to evolve. But the same thing is true with language. The type of expression, so far from providing a sure index to the level of meaning, originally was an impediment which the writer's thought could not shake off, and now easily can become a misleading signpost for the unwary interpreter. I would maintain that some of that happened to Lonergan himself, and especially with Insight, that there are some people who would read because of the emphasis on the intellectual pattern of experience, would take it as a rationalist a book. I don't think it is that, but I think it has been interpreted that way. It certainly was in its early years. There are a number of people who, because of the final chapters, would interpret it as being nothing more than rehashed scholasticism, whereas another, I think, much more legitimate interpretation of it is that it's actually an act of resistance against scholasticism. But then its turn to interiority would be taken, and was taken by a number of scholastics, as being idealist, Kantian, and so on. Well, there was there were limited tools at his disposal. And I think the appropriate modes for conveying the kind of thing that he's wishing to convey may still be evolving. What will a post-theoretical explanatory articulation from an appropriated interiority be like? What will we be talking like 200 years from now if we keep following on this movement? Do we really know yet? I don't know. Yes?
To repeat my question of before,
yes.
Exigences, how would you define that? As a need or as a necessity of some sort?
As it's a necessity, but it's not in the sense of determinist necessity. It's there is that with the kinds of questions, for instance, just to take a very simple example, the kinds of questions that Socrates, at least as he's represented by Plato, was raising. He was asking, what is justice? And he didn't want people to point to examples of justice. We can all do that. But he wanted people to give a definition of justice that applied to every case of justice and only to that. All right, now there's a certain exigence there that is called here systematic. There's an exigence to the question that is calling for, and it's an exigence for a new differentiation of consciousness. If you're going to be able to answer a question like that. Socrates couldn't answer his own questions. The people that he asked the questions to couldn't answer them. 50 years later, Aristotle attempted, but it took 50 years before somebody tried to respond to the exigence that was raised by Socrates' way of raising questions, at least if Plato is giving us a genuine presentation of what Socrates was doing. So he's demanding, placing a demand on people for a new development. Is that
thank you.
Okay, so those were the things in chapter 17 that I wanted to cover in that class, and now we can move on to chapter 18. And here, if you've got the notes for chapter 18, that would be helpful. If you don't, there's at least one other set here on the table. Notes from chapter 18. So, first of all, something that is not on the notes but that I want to emphasize at the beginning, there are two points about this approach. I think just about everybody that knows anything about Lonergan knows that with regard to decision, and the fourth level of consciousness, or whatever you want to call it, there are two very different presentations in his writing. That the presentation of insight is quite different from the presentation in method and theology. How are we to understand these differences? Does method and theology correct the viewpoint of insight? Did he see that his viewpoint in insight was really the wrong way to go at this? Or are they complementary points of view? Well, I've got two points to make in response to that question, and these are my own views. Number one, the approach to decision-making in insight is exclusively from below. It's exclusively a matter of moving from experience through understanding to judgment to decision. From below, in that sense, using the metaphor of the levels. It's exclusively from below, and so it is something of an abstraction, because I doubt that we make many of our decisions exclusively from below. We receive, as well, a lot of help from others, and that's a from above. We receive consolation from God. That's a help from above. So we don't make our decisions simply by weighing experience, understanding it, making judgments of fact, and moving to judgments of value, and then to decisions. So it's something of an abstraction. But the point that he's trying to make in the chapter, and it's made by the end of the chapter, is our own incapacity for sustained development if all we have is a movement from below upwards. If all we have is experience to understanding to judgment to decision, this chapter makes clear that there's a gap in that structure, an irreparable gap. That unless there's something else that comes from above, we are doomed to moral frustration. We can't be authentic people if all we have is experience, understanding, judgment, decision from below upwards. There must be some kind of movement from above downwards. And so what he's trying to do by pointing out from, by giving us by approaching moral living from below upwards, he's trying to point out that basically we are incapable of sustained development if this is all we have. Secondly, I have made the point a number of times, I made it a couple of weeks ago, and I've made it in some things that I've written, that I believe that we can interpret the two approaches that Lonergan takes to moral decision-making in terms of St. Ignatius's times of election or decision in the spiritual exercises. And so let me run that through that again, because I definitely want this to be, I want to get this view out, and I would like feedback on it, so I want anyone who's listening to the recording also to receive this and to hear it and possibly to respond to it. But St. Ignatius, in the spiritual exercises, speaks of three distinct times for making a decision. And I think that those times are exhaustive of all the times of making decisions. The first, because first of all, either there are, with respect to any decision that we need to make, either we have further relevant questions that have to be answered before we make the decision, or we don't. So that's the first disjunction, and there's no third alternative there. Either there are further questions or there aren't. And secondly, if there are further questions, either we are in a state of equanimity so that we can proceed in a way that raises and answers questions for intelligence, for reflection, for deliberation, or we're not. And so given those, there are three alternatives there. There are no further questions. There are further questions where we're not in a state of equanimity. There are further questions where we are in a state of equanimity. Those are Ignatius's three times. The first time is when God so touches us that we have no further questions as to what we are to do. Ignatius gives the example of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, and the example of St. Matthew when he was still a tax collector, and Jesus comes along and says, "Follow me," and he just leaves everything and follows him. Well, we don't know the interiority of Matthew at that point. We don't even know for sure if the story was exactly the way it's told in the Gospel. But there are moments in our lives, and I don't think that they are as rare as some people have made them out to be, where the first time of election is the time in which we make decisions. I can point to one clear example in my own life, if I may indicate this, but after I started working in the community with AIDS patients a number of years ago, back around 1990, a friend of mine, John Montague is his name, a former Regis College student, he just graduated with an MDiv a year ago, I believe. He said, do you know that that Bill McNichols used to run a healing service in New York at the church for persons with AIDS, with the sacrament of anointing, and like that. I said, I just knew we're going to do this. It was just like that. There was no further deliberation about it. This was exactly what the next step was called for, that we were going to do this. And I think that was the first moment of election. There were no further questions, and there haven't been ever since about doing that. There wasn't a need for exploring it. Should we do this? Should we not? It was just clear. Of course. Why didn't I think of that like that? And I think that those things happen more frequently than we might want to. A lot of people think, well, you got to be St. Paul on the way to Damascus to have the first time of election. I don't think that's true. But then the second time is the one in which there are further questions, but you're torn, you're divided, you're pulled in different ways, affectively. And then you follow the rules of discernment that Ignatius provides for the second week in the spiritual exercises. And I think Lonergan's presentation of decision-making in method and theology is a way, philosophically, of speaking of that second type of election, where it's a matter of following affectivity and going where affectivity leads you to self-transcendence and to peace. And that self-transcendent affectivity, the peace of a good conscience and so on, is the criterion for making a decision. And when you're in that type of a moment, you weigh where the consolations and the desolations, the pulls and the counterpulls are drawing you, and you go with what leads you onward to transcend yourself and to come to a peaceful resolution. But then when you're not being torn in one way or another, there's Ignatius's third way, when the soul, he says, is in a state of equilibrium. And then what one has to do, you can't go with pulls and counterpulls because you haven't got any. And so you weigh the pros and cons rationally of the various alternatives. You apply intelligence and reason, and you make what is the most rational decision. The second and the third modes have to complement each other. You've got to be peaceful with the decision that you make in the third mode. And the decision that you make in the second mode also has to be capable of being adjudicated rationally and being given a rational basis, but you didn't come to it that way. They're complementary in that sense. But you've got, which mode you use depends on the state that you're in as you're confronting a decision. Now, why am I going into all of this? Because I think the method of decision-making that is presented in Chapter 18 of Insight is a philosophical way of talking about St. Ignatius's third mode of making an election. Feeling is not important, and he even makes it very clear here in the method that he's proposing, we're prescinding from feelings. Well, that sounds, for many of us, ridiculous, because most of our decisions are fraught with feeling. So he's, but feeling here is not important in this method that he's proposing here. Feeling is the key to the decision making and method in theology. It's the key to it. And that's Ignatius's second mode. It's a philosophical way, I think, of talking about what Ignatius is speaking about in the second time of election. So those are two things that I'd like to say about this chapter before we begin. Now we have just a few minutes before we'll take a break. And I know that when we did this the last time, we were rather skimpy on some of these things early on, and I think we can be that way again today, because what I really want to get into are the issues of freedom. So at any rate, we'll go to the notes for chapter 18. Number one, can ethics be conceived as an implementation of the integral heuristic structure of proportionate being, just as metaphysics can be? So in other words, can you derive an ethics from this experience, understanding, judgment structure that Lonergan has provided, the structure affirmed in chapter 11? That's the fundamental question in chapter 18. Can an ethics be derived? We've already derived, he's certainly at least has argued, that a metaphysics can be derived from the self-appropriation of experiencing, understanding, and judging, because you've got potency, form, act, and you can do all kinds of elaborations on those. Can this also give rise to an ethics? And he says three steps are needed to answer such a question. Number one, an account of the good, of will, of value, of obligation, and that takes us through number 8 in these notes. Secondly, an account of freedom and responsibility as grounding the possibility of ethics, and that's numbers 9 to 19 in these notes. I didn't put that in the notes as I gave them to you. And thirdly, the need for moral liberation if we are to be effectively free. That whole point that I made before, that if we go only from a below upwards, it's not enough. There's got to be some freeing movement, some gift that is given to us that enables us to live a moral life. The chapter does not propose to offer a code of ethics or a set of precepts, but rather the general form of such codes. And then it basically says we can't live by these codes unless we are given the gift of love. That's the fundamental argument of the last three chapters of the book. Okay, so we'll take number 2 and number 3, and then I think we can take a break, and I don't think we need to do a heck of a lot more on the first part than that. Well, maybe we do, but anyway. The account of the good, of will, of value, and of obligation yields a method of ethics that parallels the method of metaphysics. It yields also a cosmic or ontological account of the good. So being, then, is not only intelligible and one, but also good. We've seen the intelligibility of being, we've seen how the unity of being is spoken of in terms of experiencing, understanding, and judging. Now the goodness of being. This becomes clear by extending our concerns beyond intellectual activity to deliberation, decision, choice, will, and thus grasping another isomorphism of structures. So experiencing, understanding, judging, isomorphic to that, different dimensions of the good. The good can be located on the three levels of the object of desire, corresponding to experience. Elsewhere that is called by Langevin the particular good. I'm hungry, I want something to eat. Secondly, the good of order, corresponding to insight and intellectual development. Not only do I want something to eat right now, I want to live in a system where whenever I want something to eat, I can get it. That's the good of order, okay? So that I don't have to go out scrounging and you know, like these poor people that you see digging in garbage cans to try to find something to eat every time they're hungry, you know? The good of order has left some people behind in our society. The good of order is the order that makes it possible for me. I don't have to have elaborate meals, but at least, you know, I'm not going to be starving. Whenever I'm hungry, I can get something because the society is set up in such a way that it's available and I have the means to get it. That's the good of order. And it takes insight to set up these structures. And finally, value, corresponding to reflection and judgment, deliberation and choice. There are different goods of order. We're arguing about them now. We have a new conservative party in this country, God help us, and they've got a whole vision of the good of order, which is very different from both the ruling party and the NDP. Okay? We're going to have three different conceptions of the good of order fighting each other, in a bloody manner, I think. Not really bloody, but metaphorically bloody in the next election. There are different conceptions of the good of order, and they're quite sharply divergent from one another. It's going to be an interesting type of... And the same thing in the U.S. election. There would be two very different conceptions of the good of order. And those are at the level of value, because there are some people who will die for one conception of the good of order and others for the other one. Yeah, that's the value judgments that are being made here. So number one, the good that is the object of desire when attained is experienced as pleasant, enjoyable, satisfying, and is coupled with the object of aversion, the bad. If I'm hungry, that's bad. If I find something to eat, that's pleasant, that's good, I'm feeling better. But the desire to know is not content with satisfaction, nor am I content with simply going out and scrounging every time I get hungry. We know that we can set up systems, setups, that deliver these particular goods on a regular basis with a scheme of recurrence. So I want the good of order that is generated by intelligence is not the object of any single desire. It's rather something that orders single desires, that restricts them, yet secures an otherwise unattainable abundance of satisfactions. The good of order is system on the move with a normative line of development. And this is how it develops normatively. That there's a situation, there's an insight into how to improve the situation. From that insight, you propose the improvement, you reach agreement, you execute the agreement, that gives rise to a new situation, which gives rise to new insights, and so on and so forth, and this is how society develops. But that development is marred by bias, which introduces counter moves, group bias, individual bias, general bias, that divert our energies and display the need for the attainment of the higher viewpoint beyond common sense of culture and morality. And the question of value arises when the social constructions of intelligence are in competition and force us to single out some possibilities and reject others. We have a whole proposal from Romano about the medical system in this country, and we have a whole arsenal of conservative people reacting against that, wanting to privatize the whole thing. That's the social constructions of intelligence in competition. And we're forced to single out some possibilities and reject others. To understand these activities, we must consider, Lonergan says, the conjugate potency form, and act of will, that's potency, willingness, form, willing, the act. And these together will constitute what soon after insight, by 1957 when the book was published, he was calling a fourth level of consciousness. He doesn't call it that in this book. He just speaks of an enlargement, but he doesn't speak of a new level. Yes, Chris.
I have a a question about this that I'm just trying to wrap my mind around. I kind of brought it up in the last class, but I'm still confused by it.
Yep.
And it has to do with this third level, the level of value.
Yes.
So you have the NDP, the Conservative Party, and Liberals, and they all have a different notion of order. And then, you know, people will die for this order that they believe is the right one. So they have they value this order.
That's
as
right.
The best way to go about it. But then the charge, and I was in a conversation with this with another, with a friend, and the charge that this person brought up to me is there not an exaggerated formalism going on here? That when you don't have a substantive notion of the good, that this is good and this isn't, that this somehow could permit, you know, because you have the formal aspects of an ontology of the good that can be fulfilled by different goods of order, is that enough? Like, what is going to keep us from saying that this view of order is not the right one?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I think I do. But by substantive, are they speaking here about like a what would they mean?
Well, you know, I mean, the way that I was understanding this was to contextualize it for you. It was in this. A class on Habermas, okay, and Habermas was criticizing Mead about this very notion, saying that he's giving away these substantive notions of the good, and by the way that I understood that substantive notion of the good was an idea that I guess could be defined more, not so much in terms of like a philosophy of consciousness where it pertains to the environment, the interior environment of the subject, but a good that's defined by, like, let's say, a community or something. I mean, I'm really spinning it here because
I think I see what you're getting at. I wish I had method and theology with me here, because at the very end of the chapter on the human good, he speaks about what a total view of the human good coming out of this perspective would be. The human good would be the flowering in community, okay, of all people in terms of experiencing, understanding, judging, and decision, the flowering of their affectivity, the promotion of their authenticity, the direction of all their labors to a good of order that is truly worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So the good is always concrete for Lonergan. It's never an abstraction. And so the good, as long as you're still on simply on the level of considering possible orders, you're still in somewhat in an abstract order until you reflect on it and you say, all right, this is what we really want and this is what we have to do to get there, you know? But it's always concrete. And so that's why it's always very difficult to give ethical precepts positively.
Yes.
It's you can give negative precepts. But to give positive precepts, if your ethics is one of achievement, of attainment, of creativity, and not simply of conformity.
Yes.
If your ethics is one of conformity, you can give positive precepts. But then that's, you know, who wants that? That's Kohlberg's fourth level of moral development, you know. But if your ethics is one of creativity and achievement and attainment, then we will be working out new ethical precepts, you know.
Yes. So,
and developing new possibilities for human relationships and for human community and so on as we go along, as new insights emerge.
And as this formal structure gives us the kind of theoretical grounding to where we can understand how that creative movement takes place.
That's right.
And to become more precise about
it. That's right.
But what is it that keeps us, what is it in this dynamism, in this movement, this theoretical structure that allows us to understand this movement? What is it that allows us to say Hitler's Germany, that was a concrete expression of an order that tried to eradicate a percentage of the population, a large percent of the population, that's wrong. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What is it that allows us to say that in the end? Like, theoretically, how does it work out?
Theoretically, that this, I mean, in terms of all of this, it would be the product of the massive product of bias and power, taking away people's freedom to make decisions. Any totalitarian society does this, you know. It robs people of the freedom to decide for themselves what kind of life they want to live. I mean,
so the criterion then is on restricting. If there's a restriction of intelligence, then we have a kind of violation.
If there's a restriction of the full flowering of this structure, you've got a violation. Yeah, I don't think I'd want to say just intelligence, but you know, I mean, I think one of the ways of speaking about the effects of even social injustice and the impoverishment of people and so on is that some people simply get locked into the cycles, so that they unless something really special happens, they're never going to get out to develop these potentials. They can't get out of it, you know.
Yes.
And so, I know I'm struggling for words here because I wasn't prepared for the question exactly, but the value issue is, well, I think anytime anyone issues a judgment of value with respect to a social order, you have a right to ask them, all right, well, why do you value that rather than this? I mean, you have a right to ask me why I made the derogatory statement about the new Conservative Party that I made a few minutes ago. But, you know, I'm frightened at the
yes.
possibility that they could gain power. You know, it would turn the society backwards 50 years. I'm convinced of that.
Thank you.
I'm equally at a loss for words, but I think it's related to what Chris is talking about and what you're struggling with. At what point does any desire you have to reform the system is limited by the horizon of the system itself?
Mm-hmm.
Like, to use the example, I'm still learning the Canadian system, but
mm-hmm.
the U.S. system. Yes, the Republicans and Democrats offer two very different perspectives
mm-hmm.
from one point of view.
Mm-hmm.
From another point of view, they don't.
That's right.
They're very close together.
That's true.
And any sort of radical change is simply not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And how does this, I mean, I think in terms of rationality and the questions we raise about rationality now and how it is affected by bias and how it's affected by lack of a higher viewpoint. How do you kind of think your way or rationalize your way out of a really corrupt system that you can't step outside of and see the corruption of the system?
That's good.
Oh, it's a good question, and it's the kind of thing that Chomsky is trying to raise for people in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In Theology and the Dialectics of History, I tried to offer a heuristic that at least would be at the beginning
mm-hmm.
on some of this in terms of the scale of values and,
mm-hmm.
and the dialectics of the person, the culture, and the community as they are interrelated with one another.
Mm-hmm.
The society, the vision of the society that's presented there is not one that exists anywhere.
Right.
It doesn't exist in the United States, it doesn't exist in Canada. But it is a kind of heuristic anticipation of what. Well, I mean, I was trying to make it using categories of history, what the reign of God in human affairs would be.
Mm-hmm.
What would it be if God truly reigned in human affairs?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it would be this kind of ordering. I can't go into it, the whole thing here, but vital, social, cultural, personal, religious, up and down,
mm-hmm.
affecting each other, and there would be the chance for the full flowering of human development, personal value, and so on.
You've talked about in the past about Lonergan, towards the end of his career, turning back towards the study of economics.
Yes.
That coming out of the Latin, urging from the Latin American perspective,
yes.
that it's really capitalism itself is in some way flawed, and
yes.
that you cannot erase structure. The structural problems exist because of capitalism. If you're going to stay with a capitalist,
yes.
method, the structural problems,
yeah.
it can't heal itself in
that's
that
right.
way.
That's right.
This is sort of what we're talking
he
about.
He is providing a radical alternative.
Yeah.
The issue that turned him back to it, at least one thing that was decisive, after he finished Method and Theology, he was debating, what do I do now? Do I try to write a Christology, or do I go back to economics, which is something that he was working on in the early 40s? And at Notre Dame, Gustavo Gutierrez, at a meeting on toward Vatican III at Notre Dame, Gutierrez made the comment that Latin Americans need an alternative economics to anything that's available to them today, to either Marxism or capitalism. And he said, we can't do it. We don't have the time to do it. All we have the time is to feed as many people as we can feed and make sure that the poor are helped in whatever we can do. Well, I don't have the time to sit down. But you North Americans, some of you still have enough time to do this. And that was part of the thing that determined Lonergan to turn his attention back to economics. And the alternative that he offers, I know, I don't understand it, but I know that he claims that in the alternative there is a point in the economic process itself where profit must be turned back into the society, where it cannot become the entrepreneur's prerogative. But certain profit up to a certain point is legitimate. People have to live, and they've got to pay living wages and so on. But at a certain point, it must become a social dividend. And he claims to have found the point where the process dictates that. You know, if people could only get that point. I don't get it. I don't understand it because it's so technical. But if he's right, it's a radical alternative to capitalism as it exists today. All right, I think we should take a break. I do want to get into the freedom stuff, so I think we'll move on to number 9 or number 10 on the notes when we come back, or number 9 on these notes when we come back. But I think we do need a little break, and I've got to leave at 3 because I got to get to an academic council meeting. Well, I think a couple of others of you have to go to the academic council meeting as well. Okay, but I'm going to get a glass of water. So maybe 5 minutes.